When people talk about the turbulent 1960s, there are obviously several choices for pivotal years. 1963, when President Kennedy was murdered. 1965, when the Voting Rights Act passed. 1968, the year of the Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations and the election of Richard Nixon. Our guest chooses to focus on 1967, the year of the Summer of Love and many other events. Let's set the mood with an appropriate song.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
Buffalo Springfield singing For What It's Worth, one of the many great songs from 1967. Danny Goldberg talks about that song and many more events in his book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. Danny Goldberg writes with a perspective from inside the music business. He worked as an executive at Warner Brothers Records, Atlantic Records, and Led Zeppelin's Swan Song Records. Danny was also the CEO of Air America Radio. He's currently the president of Gold Village Entertainment. All this for a guy who began his career as a journalist. Danny Goldberg, thanks for joining us. Danny Goldberg, are you there? Okay, let's listen to a little more of Buffalo Springfield while we try to get Danny Goldberg back on the line. All right, we expect to get Danny Goldberg back in just a moment here, but 1967, indeed a pivotal year with so much going on. And it's an interesting discussion to be having, too, because we just talked about Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler's Ballad of the Green Berets from 1966. So just think about how different a pair of years that was, 1966 and Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler and the Ballad of the Green Berets. And then we're talking about 1967 and the Summer of Love and just a plethora of great songs out there, including For What It's Worth, and many others that we have a chance to play for you through the course of this hour. Here we are getting Danny back on the line, so we'll resume our conversation with him right now. Danny Goldberg, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange. Danny Goldberg, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So when you got out of high school in the Summer of Love, did you want to go into the music business?
Oh, I didn't even know there was such a thing as the music business. I just thought there was rock and roll and me and my friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's probably easy for any person to say things are different from when I was 18, but boy, 1967 was that really was a different time in America, wasn't it?
Well, it was different in a lot of ways, and then in some ways, it's not as different. That's the funny thing about life. But it was an intense year culturally. It was the year that Dr. King came out against the war in Vietnam, and Muhammad Ali was convicted of draft evasion. That was a war where 20 million young men were subject to the draft, including me. So that was that. We don't have that today, that's for sure. And it was there was no internet, there was no cable television. The media was very different. It was the year that FM radio really started playing music. You know, before that, it was usually just rebroadcasting what was on AM radio. So suddenly, albums could be heard and not just singles, and that created the basis for the music business that I was able to get into a couple of years later.
People certainly would recognize the title as the name of a Moody Blues album too. But in your case, what do you mean when you say "In Search of the Lost Chord"?
Well, I graduated from high school that year, so I wasn't really part of what was going on, but I like had a front row seat. I was so mesmerized by it, and I'm trying to understand what was it that inspired me so much. It created this sense of identity and meaning of life that really stayed with me to this very day, and so many people of my age feel that. And I feel that a lot of the histories of the 60s that you see on CNN and so forth focus so much on anger and protest, it doesn't have the balance that I remembered. And I thought that the year 67 was a good year because it was before things got darker. So, I mean, it was a combination of quite a few different things that collectively created this sense that there could be a new way of organizing society, as pretentious as that sounds in retrospect. It certainly included the widespread use of psychedelics, which initially were really used as a spiritual sacrament to try to get into the meaning of life, not just to party and get stoned. It included the protest movement and the questioning of the government who had gotten us into this war that many of us just didn't understand why it had anything to do with our national security or peace and freedom or any of the things. And 50 years later, I still don't think the war was a good idea. It included a convulsive year in race relations. It's the year that Stokely Carmichael coined the phrase black power and that the Black Panthers stepped onto the stage. They were criticizing Dr. King kind of from the left, so to speak. The mainstream civil rights organizations were mad at him because he was irritating President Johnson, who had helped pass the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Bill. And I think it was Dr. King's most extraordinary year in terms of what he was saying, the depth and complexity and of his critique of capitalism combined with a deeply mystical spiritual context. He didn't take LSD, as far as I know, from reading all the books about him, but he didn't have to. He was already in that space. It was also the year that the Beatles, who were the most famous people in the world, got interested in meditation. And that word meditation, it was only something that was mentioned in the theology schools or convents or monasteries. Suddenly it was part of the pop conversation. So all of these different things and a number of others combined to create this feeling of, you know, what the Greeks called agape, you know, kind of a universal love and a sense of that there was this global community in the Western world of young people, and if they were guys, they mostly had long hair, that were somehow going to try to take these notions of peace and love and turn it into a better world. It didn't last. It didn't create utopia, but it left kind of this lingering feeling that a lot of us still yearn for, hence the lost chord. And by 68 or 69, the proportion of those things was different. So it was like taking a few strings off the guitar. Still played music, but not the same sound.
All right, we'll get some of the sounds from 1967 right now as we go to the break, listening to the Jefferson Airplane and Somebody to Love. Danny Goldberg is our guest, talking about his book In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and the hippie idea. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Procol Harum with the introduction to Whiter Shade of Pale, one of many great songs to come out of 1967, the focus of Danny Goldberg's book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and the hippie idea. Maybe you have some memories from 1967 you'd like to share. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Danny, something you said a few moments ago about meditation and how that took root in 1967. Yeah, the Beatles going to the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in India. I get a sense that this is like the year when a lot of people felt like the conformity of the 50s was finally and completely broken.
Well, I think there was a group of people, and I was certainly part of it, that felt suffocated by some of the values of the 50s. And the 50s were not all bad. I mean, it was a time of great prosperity and a great middle class. And a lot of the economic policies of the 50s I wish we had today. But there was also a materialism that pervaded a lot of the pop culture and kind of a two-dimensionality of what was in entertainment, portraying these kind of perfect families, you know, so-called Ozzie and Harriet. And there was a censorship in the arts. There was a feeling of sexual repression coming from a lot of the organized religions, and a feeling that you should trust the government. And there were, you know, of course, the government got us into the Vietnam War, and 20 million young men were subject to a draft where 56,000 of them died in a war that many of us never were convinced had anything to do with either peace, freedom, morality, or American interests. And I must say, although I question some things from 50 years ago and don't think everything the hippies did was right or that the counterculture did was right, I still believe the war in Vietnam had nothing to do with American interests. And all you have to do is go to Vietnam today and see it's not a threat to us today, and they won. So it's a vacation spot. Yeah.
The mood in 1967 for young people like you, we just talked about the fact you got out of high school in 1967. Was it really like finding your tribe to find other hippies?
For me, it was. I was just somebody that was very shy in my early teens. I just didn't have, I had like one friend at a time, and we both felt isolated from the whole rest of the world. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't getting good grades. I just couldn't relate to so much of what I was reading about in the newspapers of the so-called serious real world. And then, you know, I heard Rubber Soul and I smoked a joint and I heard Phil Oakes' song Love Me, I'm a Liberal criticizing the war and, you know, realized if I grew my hair a little longer, girls would start talking to me. And suddenly I was part of this global community of millions of people and we kind of all recognized each other. I'm not saying it was the highest form of idealism. There was a tribalism to it that had its downside and made people feel left out, but it also empowered a lot of people that used to just feel like freaks and gave a lot more space for artists and for people to express their sexuality, for people to question the government when it was wrong and to question some social mores that they disagreed with, and opened up to society, and I think it did more good than harm.
Some historians, you point out, see hippies as just plain escapist. You disagree with that, I see.
Well, you know, they were different. The counterculture was not one thing, as I mentioned earlier. And a lot of the books about the 60s were written by people on the political left who really, you know, were fixated on stopping the war. And I understand that. I wanted to stop the war also. But that looked down on the spiritual aspects of it and felt that people who took psychedelics, people who meditated, people who were putting communes together were somehow a distraction from what otherwise was going to be this serious left-wing uprising. I think, firstly, that's delusional. There was never going to be a socialist, not at those days, a socialist majority. I mean, I think this socialism is more popular today with greater distance from the Cold War. But, you know, it was never going to be a Marxist governance in the U.S. And secondly, the spiritual aspects of it enhanced the movement. They didn't subtract from it. It made it more inclusive. It reached people that weren't going to read some weighty leftist book or go to some seminar. It reached people on different levels. And I think that people like Dr. King and Joan Baez were able to balance inner spirituality and set of values with external compassion and action in a way that's a much better example than people that wanted to just denigrate and exclude, you know, hippies. So I'm pro-hippie in that respect, to the extent that there was sort of a between the political radicals and hippies. But what I'm really in favor of is a balance between the two, because, you know, you can't be for peace with a clenched fist. On the other hand, if all you're doing is sitting in isolation, unless you're a saint or a yogi, you're probably not helping the world as much as you should.
Danny Goldberg's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. You know, there are other periods in American history, obviously, when people were looking for alternatives to what the mainstream was, but they didn't gain as much traction, I think, as the counterculture did in the 60s. And I've asked this a lot in recent years of a lot of people who wrote books about that period. Did the size of the baby boom alone have a lot to do with the power of that movement?
No question about it, because not only was it the biggest generation in history up to that point, the mass media was very, very powerful. You didn't have the internet, you didn't have cable, you know, and so the mass media was fueled by advertising. Then, as now, advertising drove most of the media, and advertisers wanted young people because that's when brand preferences are formed, and that's just the way of the world. And so the media magnified these ideas. You're absolutely right. communes that existed for, you know, hundreds of years. The idea of pacifism goes back at least to World War One. Spiritual exploration goes back as long as there have been human beings. In America, you had movements like the Transcendentalists and the Beats and other things like that. But they were small groups of people in neighborhoods like Greenwich Village. In the late 60s, that energy and those bohemian cutting-edge ideas, you know, integrated into this mass media moment when the Beatles were the most popular people in the world, when Muhammad Ali was one of the most well-known people in the world, and when FM radio was opening up so you could have new ways of exposing music, when the mimeograph machine allowed the creation of hundreds of underground papers. So it was magnified by 100 times because of the size of the generation and because technology reached a point where media could reach that cohort, you know, and where the mass media wanted to reach them. So that was what made the 60s different.
And in so doing, I mean, when the advertisers began trying to make moves on that market, it just sort of brings the what is a counterculture into the mainstream of culture.
Well, that was, you know, it was a two-edged sword, no question about it. On the one hand, it reached millions of people who wouldn't necessarily be able to go to Haight-Ashbury or visit a commune. On the other hand, the crassness of it drained a lot of the symbols of meaning. The word hippie itself became a joke and a cartoon. The way people looked was no longer an indication of what was inside of them. Whether you're an FBI agent or a Charles Manson-type predator, you could grow your hair long and use words like hip and groovy. So on one hand, it magnified it, and on the other hand, it killed it. And it was a brief moment. You know, I'm not saying it was exactly 1 year or exactly in 1967, I think, but it certainly ended pretty soon and became darker and retreated back into people's inner lives and was not so much part of the pop conversation. But the fact that it was part of the pop mass appeal conversation for that year or two, I think, has continued to reverberate and inspire people.
So you mentioned Haight-Ashbury, which was the West Coast center of hippie culture, in a sense. Why did it become the center? What was it that attracted people to the Haight in the first place?
Well, firstly, the rents were very low. Yeah, Haight-Ashbury was adjacent to a mostly black neighborhood near some universities, not a trendy part of town, and so there were these big Victorian houses where, you know, with 7 or 8 bedrooms, you could rent for like $1,200 a month for the whole house. So it was a place for artists and people that were didn't want to get jobs with the big companies could live and try to be creative in an economically safe way. Secondly, San Francisco itself had a history of being hospitable to countercultural ideas. That's where Allen Ginsberg had first read his poem Howl, and it's where Lenny Bruce developed a lot of his following, and a lot of the radical labor movement was. So it had kind of some of that legacy. And then just the mystery of why certain neighborhoods attract certain kinds of people, it starts to build on itself. And by the end of 65, it was really a magnet for young people that were experimenting with psychedelics, that were interested in Eastern religion, that were criticizing the war in Vietnam, and that were just trying to have some alternative subculture. And the brilliance of some of the musicians really helped. I mean, it just so happens that the members of the Grateful Dead were there, the members of the Jefferson Airplane were there, Janis Joplin was there. They all lived in Haight-Ashbury. And, you know, those are some pretty impressive geniuses. And you had some other very talented people there, too. And so that attracted more people like that. And, you know, then you had this people opened a store for them. It was called the Psychedelic Shop, and it was the first store of that kind. Those guys then created a newspaper called the San Francisco Oracle that was documenting all this stuff, and that became a magnet for poster artists and other graphic artists. And it just took on a life of its own. But those are some of the reasons why.
Danny Goldberg's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. Perhaps you have some memories you'd like to share with us. We'd like to hear them. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. In the section about the Haight-Ashbury, a group of people I haven't heard about before, the Diggers. Who were they?
The Diggers were a small but intense group of people that were a loosely organized group with a very strong influence on the subculture. They emerged from the experimental theater world, the San Francisco Mime Troupe and others, where they would do kind of radical performance art and theater. And they lived in Haight-Ashbury. They staged a lot of the free music concerts there. They believed that everything should be free. They would gather food that was unused from supermarkets and then had a soup kitchen where hundreds of people a week were fed what they called digger stew, and they had a free store where they would get people to donate things and then give it away for free. And they were fiercely critical of anybody that they thought was trying to exploit or profit from the scene. And in some ways, they were kind of the conscience of the community, and in some ways, the scourge, because the level of anger they had would sometimes just make nobody was quite pure enough for them. They also would do weird performance arts pieces. They'd block traffic and at a square, and they'd print up interesting circulars that they would give. The two best known people in it were a guy named Emmett Grogan, who wrote a terrific memoir. He died about 20 some years ago, and it was called Ringolevio. And then Peter Coyote, who went on to become an extremely successful actor, was in movies like E.T. and does voiceovers for Ken Burns series and things like that. And they would show up also in New York and in London and other hip scenes at SDS meetings, seemingly always criticizing anybody else in the counterculture for not being as pure as they were. As I say, they were a mixed blessing to the scene, but they were a strong force in it. And I couldn't write about Haight-Ashbury without including the Diggers.
One of the major events of that year is the Be-In in San Francisco, which is, what, in January of 67?
I think it was January 14th, 67. It was, in October of 66 was the year that LSD had been made illegal in California, and there was a celebration of that, kind of a tongue-in-cheek celebration of that, where some of the bands played. And the editors of the Oracle and Richard Alpert, who was had been a Harvard professor who was fired because he was giving LSD along with Timothy Leary, another Harvard professor, to undergraduates, had moved there, and they felt that there were about 3,000 or 4,000 people at the sort of concert in October, and they realized there were all these other groups that were questioning the culture, the radicals in Berkeley who were mostly preoccupied with the war, and people in all different parts of the community that in their own way were questioning things, and they wanted to have what they called a gathering of the tribes. They called it the Be-In as kind of a pun. Firstly, the political movement had featured sit-ins in the early 60s and the civil rights movement to integrate lunch counters and so forth, and then teach-ins at universities where the first anti-war organizing was done, and then so it was kind of a riff on that, and it was also a play on words of the word human being. And so it was they had a couple of months to organize it. They had to figure out how to have everyone buy into it. The Diggers were very suspicious. It was really a scam to enrich the Haight Street merchants. They were reassured because they were given Anthony Owsley, who the big LSD dealer, gave them thousands of tablets of acid to give out for free and hundreds of pounds of turkey to make sandwiches to give out free. The musicians wanted to make sure it was respective of art and not too preachy. The Berkeley radicals wanted to make sure that it was honoring the anti-war movement. And, they had all these meetings to get everybody to buy in. And they realized that the only unifying figure they could find who was respected by everybody to be sort of an MC was Allen Ginsberg, who was then in his late 30s, but uniquely among the beatnik generation, embraced the hippie generation. He had taken LSD with Tim Leary. He was friends with the Beatles and Bob Dylan. He had been to India, so he had transcended the 50s beatnik culture and could kind of bridge the gap between all these groups. So he was the sort of master of ceremonies, and the Grateful Dead played, and a number of the other San Francisco bands, and a number of local poets and political people spoke. But the real stars was the crowd, and 50,000 people came to Golden Gate Park, 10 times more than had ever gathered at any of these occasions. And the media took note, and that was really the moment when hippies went mainstream.
Let's take a call here before we go to the break. Skeeter in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking 1967 with Danny Goldberg.
Peace and love, dudes.
Peace and love.
Yeah, man. Really. I was in the Bay Area at that in those days. I was actually the president of my senior class dorm at San Jose State. And I remember, and I think late August, early September of 67, going up with some friends. I was wearing my little penny loafers and my khakis and my little V-neck sweater, and just my jaw dropped as I walked through the Hate and, you know, going through all the head shops, incense burning, seeing a flatbed truck and a big vacant lot with people around it and a band playing on it. The Oracle was being sold on the streets. Diggers were selling their bread made out of coffee, you know, made in coffee cans.
Mm-hmm.
It was a scene. And I remember walking along the sidewalk, and this hippie dude, long hair, came up to me and squirted me in the face with a squirt gun, and I felt like I was baptized. And it changed my life, and I feel like ever since, not only me, but I think a whole lot of us have still carried that whole peace and love feeling and that human, you know, the being.
Yeah.
You know, what I carry with me from that is that not only am I an American, but I think I'm an earthling.
Yes.
And trying to recapture that sense.
But, you know, during that whole time, we were all resisting the war, and we were angry and stuff. And it was just a strange mixture of joy and rage all at the same time. And I remember my father, who was a naval officer, he was saying, you people are all complaining about what you're against. What are you for? And that made me start thinking, well, what do we want to create here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was so disappointed when the draft stopped. A whole bunch of us just sort of scattered like smoke.
Wow. Well, much more to talk about with Danny Goldberg. Thanks for your thoughts, Skeet. Appreciate that. The book is called In Search of the Lost Chord. And as we go to the break, one of the hits of that year, The Beatles, All You Need Is Love.
All you need is love.
Song from 1967, Aretha Franklin singing Respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Not just about respect for individuals within relationships, but respect for a whole generation is what the hippies were seeking back then. That is the subject of Danny Goldberg's book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. Join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Danny, you had talked about the fact that the be-in in San Francisco in January 67 certainly got a lot of media coverage, and the hippies actually finally were on the cover of Time magazine in July 1967. I mean, had the media coverage been rather, I don't know, condescending or critical up until that point?
Well, you know, the media had mixed feelings about hippies. On the one hand, it got them circulation and ratings, and that's what they were paid to do. And on the other hand, most of the people in the media were 10 or more years older, or 50 years older than the hippie generation, and felt, alienated or confused by what they were doing. So some people in the mass media kind of embraced it. The Time magazine story on the hippie was actually quite respectful, thoughtful, and good. And other pieces, like there was a CBS report that Harry Reisner did, was very condescending. It was a mixed bag. It was a mixed bag because of the politics. There were people that just were offended by anyone questioning the government during a time of war. And there were people that themselves had started to doubt the government during the time of war. And it was a mixed bag because of psychedelics. Some people were open-minded about it, and some really thought it was the road to self-destruction and drug addiction and so on. So there were all different kinds of responses.
Let me go back to psychedelics, because I think we need to underscore a little further the centrality of psychedelics to at least the beginnings of the hippie movement.
Well, there's no question that you can't talk about hippies in the 60s without heavily featuring psychedelics. Psychedelics had been in some forms around for hundreds of years, and indigenous people and Native Americans here took peyote, which mescaline derives from. But for Westerners, the LSD was discovered in the 40s by a Swiss chemist, and the CIA became interested in it as a possible mind control drug and did experiments with it in the 50s, and it turned out not to be particularly useful in time of war, but some of the people they did experiments with and made it available to saw other things in it. One was Ken Kesey, who was the famous as a novelist for his book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, who first took it as part of a government program and then became an evangelist for it, and it's documented in a book called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe. There were psychiatrists that were experimenting with it. Dr. Oscar Janneker thought that artists would be uniquely able to understand it, and Hollywood people like Cary Grant and Andre Previn took it in an early stage. And so did Henry and Claire Booth Luce. Henry Luce was the owner of Time magazine and Life magazine, and a cold warrior, not particularly attracted to Marxist or socialist politics, hated the anti-war movement, but was very sympathetic to psychedelics and ran many articles in those magazines, which were the biggest magazines in America by far at the time, at a time when magazines were very important. Again, there's no internet, no blogs. One such article was about the so-called magic mushrooms in Mexico that contained the psychedelic psilocybin. And Dr. Timothy Leary, who was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard, brilliant academic star, but who was dissatisfied with what conventional psychiatry was offering in terms of answers to the meaning of life, read the article, went to Mexico, took the mushrooms, and was forever changed and became very interested in psychedelics and became famous for giving LSD to Harvard students and became kind of a hippie celebrity advocating psychedelics. He meanwhile, had read belatedly the work of Aldous Huxley, who was a British author who'd written Brave New World, and moved to L.A. Huxley took mescaline and wrote a book called The Doors of Perception in the late 50s. And in fact, the rock band The Doors took their name from that book. And after Leary took the mushrooms, he read Doors of Perception and then sought out Huxley. They became very good friends until Huxley's death. And by a weird coincidence, Huxley wanted to die on LSD. So Tim brought him some LSD while he was on his deathbed, and his wife, Laura Huxley, ingested him with LSD, and he passed away while tripping. And the date was November 22nd, 1963, which was the same date, of course, that President Kennedy was assassinated. So if you want to go into the mystical realm and think that there was some spirit that created this whole 60s thing and inspired various people, you could look at that date as the beginning of it, because that's a pretty weird synchronicity.
It absolutely is. That's a pretty weird thing. Let's take a call here. We have Catherine and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Danny Goldberg, the author of In Search of the Lost Chord.
Hi, this is wonderful to hear. I graduated City College of San Francisco in 62 and literally walked from the campus to the Haight and stayed there during the next 4 years, and I got to witness all of it firsthand as an innocent. And there were three things that contributed to this tribal, amazing camaraderie feeling. One was LSD, of course. The second was music. The music was fantastic. It was all based on some of the best poetry I've heard since. And the third thing was the dance. And the fourth thing, I'm thinking of more than three, the fourth thing was we were next to the Fillmore, which was hopping with great black musicians that were within their own element. They hadn't crossed over yet. And I saw Ray Charles for the first time at that time. And the last thing is that it set us up for the kind of communication that you can only find in a tribe. And we discovered it on our own. So for me, this was the beginning of a psychological, spiritual self-awareness that's still unfolding in my life, and I'm in my 70s. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how lucky we felt we were to be young at that time and open. We thought, the mistake we made, of course, was that we thought we could turn on the rest of the world and that it would last forever.
Yeah, good thoughts there. Thank you, Catherine, for sharing that. But this gets back to the whole issue of resonance, the idea of resonating with other people on such a high level. And the title of the book, In Search of the Lost Chord, certainly gets into that realm. I mean, you really kind of felt like you were vibrating on the same frequency with people, I gather.
Well, yeah, I think that a lot of these sort of idealistic utopian ideas had been around for a long time. But like we said before, at intersection with the mass media, created a community of millions of people that were thinking about these things and experimenting with them. And there was a brief period of time where we could kind of recognize each other and you could kind of make instant friendships that would last for life. That period ended for various reasons. First of all, bad drugs came in. Secondly, the murders of Dr. King and Robert Kennedy just shattered a sense of possibility for a lot of people in a way that we're still recovering from the violent reaction of the FBI to the anti-war movement and the commercialization of these fragile ideas that made them into kind of cartoons. But before that moment, there was this enormous sense of community. You can get glimpses of it in the movie Woodstock, which I think is pretty accurate. I was lucky enough to be there a few years later as a early stages of my rock critic career. And I think that for people like the previous caller that tasted it, it's informed the rest of our lives. That doesn't mean you don't have to pay the rent. That doesn't mean you don't have to have ethical norms in order to be a good person. And it doesn't mean that you don't have a lot of problems in life. But it gave another aspirational idea to, you know, for people that had, for one reason or another, hadn't connected with organized religion and who were nauseated by defining themselves solely by how much money they made. And, I don't think one generation is going to make the world a perfect place. The life of Jesus Christ didn't do that either, nor did the Enlightenment. But I do think that the hippie moment was a positive thing for the Western world, and you see echoes of it today.
And for another one of our callers, here's Larry in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Larry, you there? All right, let's try the other one. Byron in Ashland. No, wait, let's try. Byron in Ashland, welcome to the Exchange.
Yeah, formerly Brad of Ashland. Thanks. Lovely program. I'm loving everything that Danny is saying. I like what Skeeter and Catherine said as well, too. I was graduating from the Wayne State School of Mortuary Science in Detroit when all this was happening, and it really attracted me. It's as if America or Western culture reaches the West Coast. They think they can get more land in, say, Vietnam. They have a Westmoreland as their general, but there is no more. And then culture bounces backwards out of that Berkeley site. Very few commentators, to me, have accurately described it. I thought Theodore Rozak's Making of the Counterculture came closer. But I love how Danny's approaching this and some of the spiritual aspects, the musical aspects. I remember Pink Floyd being way back then, and Procol Harum, and The Doors was absolutely the fantastic rock and roll going on in that era. But it's as though things have a reaction and things get co-opted. It's like long hair is no longer reliable. Merchants somehow take it over. And the same thing happened with our psychedelics. I mean, pot is still wonderful. I'm glad we have it legal in Oregon now. But the psychedelics are fascinating and marvelous benefits to humankind, but it deteriorated into speed and to heroin and things like that that people got caught up in afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I think, nonetheless, there was a spiritual, ecological kind of a renaissance of its own sort that came along, and that persists. You still see young kids walking around with Dark Side of the Moon shirts on. Mm-hmm. And the media has improved somewhat. I was curious about the Air America thing, whatever happened to that. That was a nice thing. We have MSNBC, but holy smokes, that's being co-opted as well. So here's my question to Danny, does all this go? Where does the psychedelics go? Where does the spiritual affirmation of spiritual growth and ecological kindness and sustainability go? Is it a fad? Does it only succumb to reaction? Does it reemerge, as I think it is reemerging around psychedelics right now? Well, thanks.
All right, thank you, Byron.
Well, I first of all really thank you for all that you said. I mean, so many things you said resonate with my own research and my own memories. And, you know, I think one of the things that's hard to grapple with for some of us that are in our 60s or 70s is there was this notion that, oh, we're going to change the world in our lifetime and fix all these problems. And that's childish. You know, no generation before was able to do that, and that's not really a reasonable expectation for one subculture, one group of people, or one period in time. You know, this is a vast tapestry of existence, this mystery of civilization and of the world, and we're just a small part in it. So I think that where it goes, it has to go inward to start with, and you've got to find that place in yourself that is connected with something larger. For some of us, we like the word God. Some people don't. But there is something bigger. And to find that part of yourself and the highest part of yourself to start with gives you the point of view on which to start answering this question. Then how to do something, everybody's got a different path, and you've got to do what's in front of you and not freak out because you can't fix who the President of the United States is. I wasn't crazy about the President of the United States in 1967 either. Lyndon Johnson did some good things, but boy, he did some bad things. And there's been a bunch of other presidents that I didn't think were that great. But that doesn't mean that we just give up or freak out. You have to just do the best you can in your own world. Now, as far as the role psychedelics play in it, again, as Sly and the Family Stone said, different strokes for different folks and different times in one's life. I loved taking psychedelics when I was young, and I think they were good for me. I was lucky I didn't have any bad experiences. At this time in my life, it's not what I want to do. But, you know, one thing that's good about the passage of time is the demonization of psychedelics has receded. You know, the government is now open to experimentation. The Defense Department is allowing therapists to use psychedelics for post-traumatic stress disorder victims. A lot of people are experimenting with this microdosing. It's not my thing in particular, but I think it's healthy that it's out there in the mix because different people can help themselves through different ways at different times, and it's crazy to eliminate that as a pathway.
It's a really fascinating book and certainly worth a pickup. In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967, and the Hippie Idea. Danny Goldberg wrote it and joined us today. Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for letting me talk about it. And thanks for your listeners. I felt they were all my brothers and sisters.
All right, take care. That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. We'll leave you with The Turtles and Happy Together, another song that represents 1967. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Darnell Willison's on the controls. Have a great day.
How is the weather?